With that, we'll begin with the first case, Kahn versus McCaskey. Ms. Konsky.
May it please the court, my name is Sarah Konsky, pro bono counsel for petitioners. I will be presenting the asylum portion of our appeal this morning. My co-counsel will be presenting the remaining portions of our appeal. The immigration judge made several errors of law in concluding that the petitioners failed to establish extraordinary circumstances to excuse their untimely asylum filing. This court has jurisdiction to review such legal errors. As this court's recent decision in Tariq makes clear, the court's jurisdiction to review the extraordinary circumstances determination includes legal errors. And there are several such legal errors in this case. First, there are errors in interpreting the applicable statute and regulations. Following Tariq, such errors are undoubtedly questions of law within this court's jurisdiction. In addition, the immigration judge made several errors in applying the law of the case to the undisputed facts. As petitioners argue in their brief, these are also questions of law under the Real ID Act. Petitioners submit that this is the correct reading of the Real ID Act based on Supreme Court precedent, principles of statutory interpretation, congressional intent, and the doctrine of constitutional avoidance. Indeed, the circuits that have expressly considered the arguments that we're making in our brief have concluded that the Real ID Act does restore jurisdiction over more than pure questions of statutory interpretation.
But see, I think you have a problem with the Vasily case of this court because this question was specifically considered. And it seems to me what you're trying to do is cast your appeal to fit into the question of law mode.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, we argued that there are several questions of statutory and regulatory interpretation in our case. And following Tariq, those are undoubtedly questions of law. And we also argue that the mixed questions of law and fact should be considered questions of law and should not be the types of factual or discretionary determinations that the Vasil case held were outside of this court's jurisdiction. So while we certainly agree that Vasil does remove this court's jurisdiction over factual or discretionary determinations, we argue that that's not what's before the court in this case, and we're not squibbling with the factual or discretionary portions of the immigration judge's decision.
Doesn't that gut the jurisdiction stripping provision entirely if we have jurisdiction to review the application of the law to the facts, because that will be involved in every single decision that is essentially of a discretionary nature?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, it would still remain that factual determinations would not be within this court's jurisdiction. So we would only be talking about cases as ours where the facts are essentially undisputed. While the court would arguably have more jurisdiction than it does under a very narrow reading of the Real ID Act, we would argue that this is nevertheless the proper interpretation of the Real ID Act based on Supreme Court precedent and the correct reading of the statute, as well as doctrine of constitutional avoidance and avoiding the suspension clause problems that the Supreme Court recognized in the St. Cyr decision. So the framework for interpreting the Real ID Act must be the St. Cyr decision. In that case, the Supreme Court recognized that the Supreme Court of the Constitution mandates that aliens have a judicial forum to review those claims that would have been reviewable on habeas as it existed in 1789. And the court went a step further to explain what that review on habeas was in 1789, stating that it encompassed detentions based on errors of law, including the erroneous application or interpretation of statutes. And that was the backdrop against which Congress passed the Real ID Act. In the legislative history, Congress made clear that it was attempting to streamline the removal decision process while still meeting the constitutional requirements of this asylum process that were recognized by the Supreme Court in St. Cyr. And the legislative history also makes clear that the Congress intended a certain review of mixed questions of law and fact. Specifically, it states, when a court is presented with a mixed question of law and fact, the court should analyze it to the extent that there are legal elements, but should not review any factual elements. Thus, it was intended that the Real ID Act would provide an adequate and effective substitute to habeas review. And we submit that nothing in the text or the legislative history of the Real ID Act compels a narrow construction of the term questions of law. As I noted, the three circuits that have expressly considered the argument we're raising today have each found that there is the more broad review under the Real ID Act. Those are the 2nd, the 9th, and the 11th circuits. The government's reliance on Basile and Sevilla to limit the court's jurisdiction is misplaced in light of both the Supreme Court's decision in St. Cyr, the legislative history, and the recent decision in Tariq.
But those circuits that you cited, where they've made those findings, there is a distinction in terms of the factual scenario in our case. They've done that mixed question of law and fact.
In both the 2nd and the 9th Circuit's decisions, they involve the same statutory scheme that we have here, the changed circumstances.
I know it's the same statutory scheme, but I'm talking about the factual scenario and the actual findings that the court made.
We would submit that it's the same situation as in our case, where the underlying facts are undisputed, and the question is the correct application of the law to the facts. Notably, in the 9th Circuit case of Ramadan, the court did decide that the facts were undisputed, and they therefore had jurisdiction to determine whether the petitioner had established changed circumstances, which is analogous to the extraordinary circumstances determination in the same statute. And they did proceed to consider that mixed question of law and fact, ultimately, however, determining that there was not a sufficient error to overrule. But we would argue that that's the exact same situation in this case, where the facts are undisputed and the question is whether the law was applied correctly.
Now, you're into your rebuttal time. Do you want to save any time?
No, Your Honor. I'd like to allow my co-counsel to argue. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Catherine Graff, and I will be discussing the withholding and removal portions of our argument. There are many reasons why the IJ's decision denying Mr. Khan's petition for withholding of removal is not supported by substantial evidence in the record. However, unless there are questions, I would like to address why Mr. Khan's kidnapping, detention, and torture constitute past persecution under this court's precedent, and why this persecution was on account of Mr. Khan's political beliefs. In May 1998, Mr. Khan was kidnapped by the MQM. He was detained for 3 days in a remote location outside of Karachi. Over the course of those 3 days, he was beaten with a club, punched, and kicked. The MQM also threatened to cut off Mr. Khan's fingers and backed up this threat by showing him a box of severed fingers and fingernails. When Mr. Khan was released, he consulted a doctor who told him that he had internal injuries and that he could have died as a result of those injuries. Under this court's precedent, this single incident of kidnapping and torture is sufficient to constitute past persecution. Furthermore, this torture was severe enough to constitute persecution under this court's precedent. As a result, the IJ's decision to the contrary was not supported by substantial evidence in the record.
What evidence is in the record about the unwillingness or inability of the government to prevent the
control the MQM?
Future persecution that's at issue here?
With respect to the MQM, it is a body that the Pakistani government is unable or unwilling to control. There is evidence in the record in the form of the State Department, the country reports, both from 2002 to 2003, indicating that the MQM is a Sindh-based urban political party that has used violence in the past to further its aims. Similarly, the MQM is now part of the ruling coalition in both the Sindh province and the national government. So from that, it's pretty clear that either the Pakistani government is unable or unwilling to control the MQM. Furthermore, there is precedent in that we cited Kaiser versus Ashcroft granting an asylum claim based on persecution by the MQM.
And Mr. Khan, did he make some mention of the fact that the president is more friendly to the MQM than it was when he fled?
I believe so. There is some evidence. Mr. Musharraf is Urdu-speaking. Members of the MQM also are from an Urdu-speaking group. And so there is some evidence that Mr. Mouchard is friendly to the MQM. He, as far as we know, he's not a member of the MQM, but the MQM, like I said, is part of the coalition government that's ruling Pakistan. This persecution was on account of, it was on account of Mr. Khan's political beliefs. And we know this because while he was held by the MQM for those 3 days, he told them that you are a traitor, your families are traitors, you are an informer, and you don't believe. From the context of what was going on when they told him this, it's clear that this belief to which they're referring is Mr. Khan's belief in the MQM's political agenda. Turning to our reopening arguments, again, there are many reasons why the board abused its discretion in the reopening decision. However, I'd like to focus on the fact that the evidence is new and the fact that the board failed to adequately consider this new evidence. First, we wholly disagree with the government's contention that the facts provided in the Kovler affidavits are not new. However, even if this is true, under the relevant statute in this court's precedent, the proper standard is whether the material evidence is new. These affidavits clearly present evidence that was not available to the IJ when he made his original decision, and therefore are new.
And then why wasn't it available to the IJ?
Your Honor, that was not a base. The board did not base its decision on the fact that it was previously unavailable, and so we've been focusing on the newness of the affidavits.
I understand, but I'm just saying, why wasn't it available? Because the doctors, in terms of the exams that took place, give me the timing of that.
The doctors examined Mr. Khan in early 2007. And so the board made its initial decision in 2003, 2004, and therefore they were not before the board at that, or the IJ, when it made its decision.
And there was no evidence, or he never attempted to go to the doctor back in 03 or 04?
No, Your Honor. He did visit a couple of doctors not experts in torture and psychological or mental disabilities. Mr. Khan was unaware of these, the pro bono services provided by the Kovler Center, and did not have the financial wherewithal to provide care, get his own psychological care. So the evidence here is clearly new. Furthermore, the board abused its discretion in failing to adequately consider this evidence. Under this court's precedent, the board must announce its decision in terms sufficient to enable a reviewing court to perceive that the board has heard and considered the evidence and not merely reacted. While the BIA considered some of the new evidence in its opinion, it only considered the evidence that supported supported the government's ultimate conclusion. The BIA did not provide any evidence in its decision that it considered the details in the affidavits that would support Mr. Khan's position.
This is actually a pretty thorough BIA opinion as these go. I mean, it's more than a couple of sentences, as we often see. It does talk about the specifics of the evidence. It places it in the context of what was found and concluded before the IJ, and is actually, as I said, pretty thorough as these opinions go. Maybe you could address that in context.
Of course, Your Honor. While the BIA did provide some evidence, they did consider some of the evidence in Ms. Bunn's affidavit in particular. The BIA did not address any of the evidence in Dr. Goldberg's report regarding the physical evidence, and the BIA did not show any evidence that it considered the portions of Ms. Bunn's affidavit that would support a finding of a mental disability establishing extraordinary circumstances. While we don't think the board should have to go through every piece of evidence possibly available, we do think that the board should have provided some evidence that it considered both sides of the argument, weighed the evidence addressing both sides of the argument, and then reached its conclusion.
But wasn't most of this evidence cumulative?
Your Honor, no, it wasn't. It's not cumulative. It's cumulative in the sense that, of course, it supports Mr. Khan's his petition. It's not cumulative in that The affidavits were new. They provide professional diagnoses, evidence that was not before the board. Furthermore, the board in its decision denying Mr. Khan's petition regarding the asylum application specifically mentioned that Mr. Khan had not provided expert objective evidence.
Well, you're into your rebuttal time, but I did have one comment in terms of cumulative. The IJ specifically accepted that he had suffered from mental problems, for example.
Yes,
and that was included in the new information.
Yes, Your Honor. But Ms. Bunn's affidavit in particular shows that we're not just dealing with mental problems here. We're dealing with adjustment disorder, which is recognized by the psychological community as a disorder with significant impairment. We also know that he was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder when he first arrived in the United States.
All right.
So,
thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Graff. Mr. Palau?
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Manuel Palau for the Attorney General here. I would like to first address the issue that keeps getting glossed over here, which is that the record evidence here simply does not compel the conclusion that the alleged acts of persecution here were carried out by the government of Pakistan. The testimony is clear that the acts against Mr. Khan were carried out by MQM, one of many political parties in Pakistan that uses terrorist techniques. They're the ones who carjacked his vehicle and abducted him. And that being the case, there is simply no evidence here that the government of Pakistan is the one who acted against Mr. Khan. And that's a requirement for the asylum and withholding and CAT claims here. Unless there's government action, there is no basis for relief. Here we're looking at substantial evidence standard of review. There is simply no evidence in the record that the government here was unable or unwilling to act against MQM. In fact, the evidence here shows the opposite. The country reports indicate that on several occasions the police have cracked down on MQM for their terrorist activities. Mr. Khan himself was arrested by the police because they thought he was a member of MQM who had carried out terrorist acts. So it's clear here that the police actually were acting against MQM. Additionally, the whole purpose of the abduction, according to Mr. Khan's testimony, is they thought he was informing on them to the police, and they wanted him to stop informing on their criminal activities to them, and that's what they wanted to get from that abduction. So the whole point here is that under the substantial review standard, there is no evidence in the record upon which the court could find that the government here is the one that carried the actions out. Without government action, all the other issues in this case, I would submit, are moot because all the claims fail without government action.
Now, do you dispute the fact that MQM's power in Pakistan has increased over the last 10 years and that the party seems to hold the majority of elective offices? Doesn't that suggest that it might be unsafe for him to return?
What I would answer is that may suggest they're making gains in the government. That doesn't translate into the record evidence here is clear that activists, operatives, and thugs from the party are the ones who took the actions here, not MQM as any kind of government entity or any arm of the government here. So while that may be something you could suppose or assume from the record, that's not the record that was before the IJ. And even that assumption does not translate, turn this into government action or government acquiescence. There's simply nothing in the record which says that the government of Pakistan acquiesces in MQM's criminal activities. And beyond that, I would point out that MQM, under the country reports, is prominent only in the Sindh province and the city of Karachi. They're a very regional, localized group. The country reports say that they have very little influence outside of Karachi. So that's another indication that the actions here were not taken by or with the acquiescence of the government, and all his claims for relief fail on that basis, and all the other issues become moot. On the question of whether the actions here were taken on account of Mr. Khan's political opinion, I would submit that there is substantial evidence of record to support the agency's finding that the carjacking was an economic crime, and they stole his vehicle to further their political activities, not because of any views that Mr. Khan may have held, but the fact is it's an economic crime, and they extorted money from not just people like Mr. Khan, but everybody in the neighborhood, irrespective of their religion or political beliefs. Secondly, there's substantial evidence in the record that as to the abduction and kidnapping and beating by the MQM thugs of Mr. Khan, that the purpose of that, there's enough evidence to support the IJ's conclusion that they thought he was informing on them to the police. And they said, if you inform on us to the police, we'll cut your fingers off in the future. When he promised to not do so, they finally let him go. There's no evidence that the purpose of that abduction was to get him to join their cause or to resume contributions to their cause. It was to coerce him into not reporting their criminal activities to the police, which is what they thought he was doing. And that standing alone, you may not agree with that from a de novo standard, but here we're talking about substantial evidence. That's sufficient evidence in the record to support the conclusion that his abduction and beating was not on account of his political views. In fact, he testified that when he left the party in 1994, he became politically inactive. As to the issue of the motion to reopen, the motion to reopen is based on the agency's finding that his asylum application was untimely. As this court has noted in Vasily, that determination by the agency is outside the court's review. Counsel has cited the Tariq case, which states that questions of law may be reviewed nonetheless under the Real ID Act. But here, there are no pure questions of law that were the basis for the IJ's the board's decision, rather. Here, the facts regarding why Mr. Khan missed the asylum deadline, why he filed it 5 years after he arrived, are in dispute. He gave several varying interpretations of why he filed it late. He first said he didn't know he could file for asylum. He also said that his focus when he first got here was to provide for his family. He also said that he feared filing for asylum because if MQM found out about it in Pakistan, they might hurt his family there. Finally, he said that he suffered from mental disability, which prevented him from filing the asylum application for 4 years after the deadline. These are all questions of fact that the agency had to resolve in order to make its determination whether his filing was excused by extraordinary circumstances or not. This is not a situation where there are undisputed facts. Additionally, even beyond those reasons, when one looks at the evidence that he proposed that his mental disability kept him from filing, there were other facts in the record that the IJ looked at and considered, evidence to the effect that despite his mental disability or whatever psychological trauma he had, he was able to hold down a job, support his family, pay rent for an apartment, meet his other legal obligations, send money to his family in Pakistan. So he was able to function. And again, there's at the very least, a mixed question, but I would say these are all purely fact questions of law, fact questions that the IJ had to resolve, the board had to resolve, in order to decide whether this extraordinary circumstances existed or not. This is not the case to reconsider the holding in Vasily, which takes into account the Real ID Act and the jurisdiction stripping provision, which precludes review by this court. So I would submit that if the court would look at the so-called questions of law, which are stated in the petitioner's brief, I think it's fair to say that those are at best mixed questions of law and fact, and I think most of them are merely statements the court made in the context of the evidence presented. There was no, I still have yet to hear which statute or regulation the court looked at and misinterpreted and made a broad statement about what that statute or regulation requires. All the comments made by the court were in the context of the evidence in this case. So I would submit to the court that there are no legal questions here to be decided, and that I believe, as Judge Sykes mentioned, I think you're on the money, that what's happening here is because the court lacks jurisdiction, the petitioner is trying to fashion their case or fit their case into that exception to the jurisdictional provision. It just it's not a good fit here. It doesn't work. I would also point out that we could have a discussion about whether this rises to the level of persecution or not. But again, we're here under the substantial evidence standard, and there's adequate evidence in the record to support the IJ's decision, which I would agree with the court is, I thought, extraordinarily thorough and considered not just the law at issue, state of the law, and also carefully considered all the facts, laid out alternative findings here, and the board did similarly in reviewing the decision. Unless there are any further questions.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Pillai.
Your Honor.
I'll give you 1 minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. We actually just have one point that we wanted to clarify. Under this court's precedent, there can be more than one motivation for persecution, so long as one of the motivations is protected by the statute. Now, there is some evidence in the record indicating that Mr. Khan's kidnapping, detention, and torture was in part motivated by the belief that he had informed on them and the desire to prevent this from happening again. But it's equally clear from the sequence of events preceding the kidnapping, as well as the language the MQM used while they were detaining and beating Mr. Khan, that the major motivation was political, that they were angry that he had refuted the MQM's political agenda. And, Your Honor, that's all I've got.
All right. Thank you. And you were appointed and working pro bono in this case, and so we thank you for the very fine briefs and oral argument, Ms. Konski and Ms. Graff and your law firm. And Mr. Pillai, we thank you for your fine brief and your argument. We'll take the case under advisement and call the next case.